This is the CompuSchmooze podcast, episode 29, for Wednesday, February 11th, 2009. Welcome to the CompuSchmooze podcast. In this episode, we'll have two interviews. First, we'll talk with Adam Wright of Ipsos, a market research firm, about some of their findings about how people are using online video. Then we'll speak with Persephone Miel, a fellow at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at the Harvard Law School, where she's doing research into the news media. She's released a report recently called News and Information as Digital Media Come of Age. Hi there, I'm Steve Lubetkin, host of the CompuSchmooze podcast. Since 1996, I've been writing the CompuSchmooze technology column in the Jewish Community Voice of Southern New Jersey, on the web at jewishvoicesnj.org. This podcast is a supplement to the newspaper column, and it lets my readers get behind the column to hear the voices of the people who provide us with our stories. In our first interview in this CompuSchmooze podcast, we'll talk with Adam Wright. Adam's a senior research manager at Ipsos, which is a Canadian consulting firm that specializes in a number of market research studies. Adam's been with Ipsos Insight since 2005 and has more than 10 years of research and marketing experience. Over the latter half of 2008, the popularity of online video services grew significantly, in particular with women and older consumers, helping to close the age and gender gap within the online video audience in the United States. And some of the data from Ipsos Media CT's motion study illustrates that online video services are becoming more widespread in their appeal, and a great many internet users, including people over 35, are starting to look at streaming and online video as a way to get their content. Adam Wright, welcome to the CompuSchmooze podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Adam, you have just completed and released the results of a study about people using online video streaming. What are you finding out? And it seems to be a little bit surprising these days.
Well, I think we find something out that's new each quarter we go in the field. The latest press release highlights findings from earlier this summer where we survey online adults to get a sense of how many are enjoying streaming video and downloading video. And the latest results tell us it's clearly that the whole age and gender gap is closing within the digital video space. So most of the gains that we saw in past 30-day video streaming were entirely driven by women or consumers older than 35 and older. The other age groups and gender and obviously men pretty much were flat when we look back across the last year. And so we thought that was probably the most telling statistic overall coming out of that wave of field work.
Why are we suddenly seeing an uptick in older people and in women taking a look at online videos?
Although we don't necessarily ask awareness and familiarity with streaming, I think all of those typically are precursors to increases in usage and adoption in the way that we sort of view trial and adoption is ever streaming versus past 30-day streaming, and the same thing for downloading. And because we saw the uptick in past 30-day usage, I think it's safe to say that at this point, most consumers, or online consumers for that matter, are aware of this whole notion of getting content, streaming it online, whether video content, whether it's the TV shows they want to watch, potential movies, concert clips, news updates, and obviously, the ubiquitous home video that's posted on sites like YouTube. So I think that the message is out there, and at this point, the hurdles, whether it's mental or physical, mostly a mental hurdle of, do I want to do it? Is it too much trouble? Those have been sort of jumped over by these groups, and they're really embracing digital video, at least from what we can see.
So what does that mean for the mainstream broadcast video media?
Well, if your media is targeting these folks, a year ago, if you were hesitant to deploy whatever, if you're relying on traditional channels to attract an audience with these folks with your video, your entertainment video, at this point, if you haven't done it already, you better start thinking about digital channels to reach these consumers, because it's very clear they're adopting streaming video in particular as a dominant platform for watching the video content they want to consume today.
What are some of the other findings you came up with that were surprising to you?
You know, that was the biggest one. I mean, you know, there's different trends that we see within the types of video, and we're seeing a slow, gradual increase in the amount of consumers that are downloading, or not downloading, but streaming television shows online. So it's still a relatively niche activity, but you're seeing it increase quarter over quarter, year over year, slowly, and it's not just within what you would think is sort of the traditional early adopter stereotype of the young male, but across all age groups. So that's the other thing that we've been monitoring, and they're seeing some nice gains there. Movies are still a very niche genre from a streaming perspective.
Is there any information in your survey about whether people are looking at longer videos than they have in the past, or is it pretty much short bites?
Well, short bites, I mean short clips, blips, however you want to describe them, shorter form content still rules the space. However, as I mentioned before, TV shows are starting to make some inroads here, and that's really what's driving sort of this longer increase in longer form video consumption, whether it's streaming or downloading. But, but by and large, movies are still relatively niche. And until I think that becomes something you can very, very easily do on your TV, you know, you're still going to see that category struggle a bit, because consumers, by and large, want to view that content via this 10-foot experience with their feet up on the ottoman, watching from their couch on their large, you know, their large 40-inch HD TV, because they've made that investment there. Television shows, it looks like the trade-off between consuming it on a PC or on their mobile video device, that is becoming more and more of a acceptable way to watch video. And that's another thing that we've monitored too, is where all this video, the share of disposable time is being spent for watching video. And the PC is really seeing some gains there as well. They've doubled their share of screen time in the last year, taking it right from TV. Now, TV still dominates. About 75% of all video content that's consumed is viewed and consumed through TV, but that's down almost the exact same percentage as we've seen an increase in the PC and other sort of mobile devices.
Adam Wright is a director with Ipsos Media CT, part of Ipsos Insight Market Research. Thanks for being with us on the podcast, Adam.
Thanks a lot.
That's Adam Wright from Ipsos Research in Canada. And if you'd like more information about his research on people using online video, you can use this shortened URL. It's is.gd/4VQR, and the VQR are capitalized. You can find the complete news release and package of information about the Ipsos research. Now on to our second interview with Persephone Miel of Harvard University. Persephone Miel is a fellow at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at the Harvard Law School. She's the director of the Media Republic Project, which is examining the impact of participatory journalism on the information environment. Before joining the Berkman Center, Persephone spent more than 12 years with Internews Network, an international non-governmental organization supporting independent media around the world. She designed and managed a variety of projects to support the growth of non-state news media, including TV, radio, print, and online outlets in the former Soviet Union, and she participated in program design and development for Internews projects in other parts of the world. She lived in Moscow from 1992 to 98, and from 93 to 94, she was the host of an English language morning news show there. Persephone Miel, welcome to the CompuSchmooze podcast.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Persephone, tell us a little bit about the study that you've completed. It's pretty much of a landmark study on the whole issue of where the internet is taking print publications, and you came up with some broad basic findings, about six of them, if I remember correctly, in the summary. What did you find about what's going on in the media?
Well, first of all, the study is called Media Republic, and it's republic with a colon, meaning about the public. And I really tried to take it from a somewhat different point of view than I think a lot of other people are coming from. There's a lot of people studying the decline of the news media, especially the print news media, and there are a lot of people studying what's happening in participatory media, which is the phrase we tend to use for online citizen media. But I'm not interested in either of those things by themselves. What I'm interested in is what's happening to the system that might be producing the news and information that people need. And, you know, we had one system and there's all kinds of new things happening and the two are merging. But what's interesting to me is the news and information that people need getting produced, meaning is the journalism that's needed being done? And I think that, you know, in a lot of places it is, and a lot of it is getting done by some of these new systems, including volunteer citizen journalists and all kinds of other things and people just contributing. But in a lot of places, it's not. And for me, it's not about saving newspapers per se, not as newspapers, but it is very much about what can we do to save the kinds of journalism that we have relied on newspapers to provide and that are not being provided in this new world. So I kind of tried to look at it from that point of view. And the conclusions we came up with are around different pieces of that. Basically, the conclusions are that the traditional media, the legacy media, are increasingly cutting back on or being forced to cut back on doing certain kinds of journalism, and that much of the new media that's coming up is doing lots of interesting things and serving lots of people, but it's not doing everything. And it's especially not doing specific things that newspapers are cutting back on as their budgets shrink and shrink. So for me, the question is, how do we get to the place where somebody will do that work, and who is it going to be?
Well, most of the mainstream news media have been struggling with this model for several years now, trying to figure out how to get advertisers to pay enough to justify the time that they're spending on and the investment they're making on their websites. What conclusions did you come up with? Is it going to be a nonprofit sort of thing? Is it going to be funded by foundations or what?
I do believe that there's going to be a need for much more nonprofit models and involvement of nonprofit organizations in journalism. I don't necessarily think that's going to be foundation-funded, you know, news organizations, but I do think that there's going to be a huge need for different kinds of nonprofit organizations that are doing things to make sure that journalism on the topics they're concerned about is getting done. And it may also mean more nonprofit news. I mean, if you look at some of the examples that we do have of, you know, the BBC, The Guardian, the Christian Science Monitor, the St. Petersburg Times, of media that sell advertising, but where they're not driven by profit. I think that's going to be a strong piece of the new media environment.
You have some of those publications are even curtailing the way they publish the print publication, or changing the way they publish it in order to, what, cut costs, save money, do it in a different way. Is that having an impact?
Yeah, print media of all kinds are changing what they do in pod paper. And I think that's natural, and I don't think that's necessarily, again, that's not necessarily the point. What's on paper and what's not on paper is not the problem. It's the question of whether they'll continue to do the expensive kinds of journalism. It doesn't bother me if they do, as long as if they're doing the kind of journalism that they need to do and people are able to get that information, and it doesn't matter to me whether they get it on paper or on the web or on the radio or the television, you know.
Right. And, in fact, one of the things that I hear frequently when people are getting together and talking about this whole issue is that people who own traditional publications like newspapers have to stop thinking of themselves as printers and start thinking of themselves as content producers.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, or they have to become something else. I mean, it may be that some of the newspaper companies or other media companies realize that they're not content producers. I mean, lots of smaller newspapers producing content was not a big piece of what they did. You know, I mean, in a small town where there's not that much news and not that much money to support a big reporting staff, a lot of what the newspaper was doing was delivering the Associated Press to people's doorsteps and local advertising, which is important. So, you know, that may be mostly the business they're in, and it may be that their news desk should be what spins out and becomes a nonprofit, and they stay in the business of selling local advertising and packaging something in a way that reaches people.
Now, you also say in the report that one of the risks that this transition, this evolution we're going through causes for people is that they may start to rely on news sources that are perhaps not as reliable or credible as the traditional sources. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, that's a huge issue. I mean, this is something that, again, people have been worrying about ever since, you know, blogs started 10 years ago, and people have been, especially traditional journalists, have been, oh my God, we can't figure out who these people are and you can't trust them. But it, you know, the credibility thing is a real issue, and it's a very complicated issue, I think, that has a lot of different pieces that have to be addressed. It's not going to be one answer. I mean, there were a lot of people at some point who wanted to, you know, set up some way to code blogs so you could say, put a sticker on them and say, yes, this blogger is for real and, you know, we know who he is. But that's not going to be what's happened. It has to be some combination of educating people and also systems to make it easier for the people who are delivering and aggregating news to make it clear to people what they're getting. Like, there's a really interesting project being started by folks in England who are setting up a way for all content producers, blogs, wire services, newspapers, television, to use the same data about the stuff they produce so that when an aggregator gets it, they know that it's reliably coming from, you know, if it says Reuters, there's a way for them to check that it's really coming from Reuters, and they know when it was published and who published it.
It's sort of like a good housekeeping seal of approval almost.
Yeah, except they're not going to say who's good and bad. They're just going to say that they're just saying that they are who they say they are, and they're standardizing things like dating of, time stamping of articles, which, you know, seems incredibly easy, except that you read these stories like what happened with the United Airlines thing. I don't know if you saw that.
Oh, sure. That was the case where a story about a bankruptcy that happened seven years ago.
Yeah.
It appeared up on a web feed and everybody thought the company had gone bankrupt.
Yeah, exactly. One analyst pulled it up in a Google search and then repeated it. And once it came out of his desk at Bloomberg or wherever, it became real, you know, and the stock crashed in half an hour. It's crazy.
So, you know, do you think people are going to be spending more time relying on bloggers? I mean, one of the things that the mainstream media always gave to opinion writers and opinion even leaders was the cocoon of authority, you know, that if we're publishing it, therefore there's something to be said for it. How's that going to work in the new world?
Oh, but that's already working in the new world. I mean, there is already a whole set of gatekeeping going on of bloggers, by bloggers. You know, it's already, that's already completely intermingled, in fact. I mean, I no longer think it doesn't even make that much sense to talk about blogs as a separate category anymore. Blogs are a tool that are now used by 95% of American newspapers and a whole bunch of other people, including, you know, there are corporate blogs and advocacy blogs and all kinds of things that are calling themselves blogs. And that's already happening, that there's a whole new way of that people get their sense of what the reputation is of an opinion person. And again, I don't think that's the biggest problem. You know, blogs that are out there to be opinionated and that people who are reading them as blogs or as opinion pieces, they know what they're reading. That's, you know, that's not where the credibility problems come up, quite honestly. I mean, for me, the credibility problems come up when corporations are paying to place press releases that look like news and articles are getting into the mix in these aggregators where people don't really see the difference anymore. It's not the political blogs that are really the danger in that sense.
You think that the corporate news releases need to be segregated in some way?
Well, I think there needs to be more education of people, audiences, so that they know. And I think there needs to be a bigger push by online news organizations, whatever they are, publications, to be transparent about what they're doing and be better at that. And even the mainstream media are not so good at that. And sometimes it's simply because they haven't figured out how to make that things clear in their online presence. I mean, one of the problems that people have in terms of not so much credibility, but in terms of finding, you know, a comprehensive news source that they understand, is that even the same newspaper online is very different. I mean, the process of reading it is so different online, and people have not figured out how to create those same signals to people that says, this is an advertisement, this is opinion, this is an article, this is analysis. You know, people, all the newspapers are constantly changing and trying new things on their websites, which is normal, but they haven't settled in yet to some kind of thing that says, okay, now you've actually read the paper, or you've read as much of the paper as, you know, you plan to read. You've got the virtue of our editorial intelligence telling you this was what was important today. Because if you started on one article and then you skip to something else, and, you know, just your navigation of the paper is so different online.
Yeah, I know. I find myself jumping around a lot more when I read, for example, the New York Times online. I don't read it cover to cover the way I would have if I actually had the print publication in front of me.
Yeah, there's a whole set of different habits that people haven't. And, you know, there's a way that people got news that was based on those habits. I mean, even if it was just flipping the paper and catching that glimpse of the headline and thinking, okay, I'm not going to read that article, but somehow you learn something about it. And so if it was there, if the same story about Greek riots is there 10 days in a row, you might eventually read something about it, whereas you might miss it entirely if you were reading your news in an aggregator in a different way, or even just reading the New York Times online.
Persephone, your report spends a lot of time on what you call participatory journalism, the fact that now with the web communities the way they are, that the legacy media can engage their audiences in actually helping them gather the news. And CNN has done this with its iReport, and mm-hmm. some others have done it. where do you think that's going to shake out? Do you think that's going to continue to be important? Do you think it's going to diminish over time? Where is it going?
That's a good question. I can't see it diminishing anytime soon, because I think there's still a huge, I know there's still a huge population that hasn't even begun to be engaged with it, and some percentage of that population will. I mean, you can see if you look at the statistics on the rise of people who are participating in small ways and big ways. I mean, not every, you know, participatory media isn't just about writing a blog. It can be as simple as voting for an article, emailing it to someone, putting in your restaurant review. There's a lot of different pieces of it. And I do think that will continue to grow, and I think people will become more sophisticated about it, which doesn't mean I think that necessarily it will ever fill in certain kinds of gaps. And I think there's a lot, I think that's going to take very concerted effort by people to make sure that people's participation is contributing to journalism, to real journalism, and most importantly, to make sure that we're really getting not necessarily participation by everyone, but that everyone has an option to participate and has the option to get the news and information they need, even if they don't want to participate. Which I sometimes refer to as standing up for the couch potatoes, but it's also standing up for the people who don't want to go online, the people who don't have computers in their homes, people whose jobs don't involve sitting in front of a computer all day, and who really need to be able to come home and turn on the television and still get some semblance of real information about what's going on in the world.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if the free model is going to sustain itself over time. I remember a comment that George Lucas, the filmmaker, made to Kara Swisher in the Wall Street Journal a couple of years ago when she asked him about YouTube. And he said it was amazing to him how many people were willing to work for free.
Mm-hmm.
And it amazes me that there are many people willing to produce videos and produce photos and reports from things simply for the quote-unquote glory of getting in an iReport or getting onto some newspaper website. Do you think that people are going to be satisfied with that for the long term, the citizen journalists?
I think there will be leveling off. I mean, people will – I don't know. That's a really – it's a big question, actually, of whether – I mean, I think there will always be some group of people who will do stuff for free, but I don't think – I mean, if you look at what YouTube really is, I mean, most of what people on YouTube do for free is for their own entertainment and the entertainment of their friends. I mean, most of it is not the kind of work that's involved in putting together, you know, a news report. It's people taking videos of home videos of their kids and, or, you know, if they're friends or each other. So people are doing it as entertainment. They're not doing it as civic volunteering. I do think there will be always be people who, I think it will become one of the things that people do as volunteers. Excuse me. And I, you know, actually hope that there will be more people organizing things so that people can do it in a meaningful way. And instead of it being, you know, 20 people writing their opinion about Sarah Palin and no people writing about the city council.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've seen an awful lot of, you know, spot news events that, you know, citizen journalists have taken it on themselves to provide information coverage. We had the terrorist attacks in Mumbai. There have been other, you know, natural disasters and things like that where people are, you know, sharing photos, sharing video from the scene. And that stuff gets used very regularly. The point that you make about, you know, who's covering the town council, who's covering what's happening locally. Do you think hyperlocal, which has become a buzzword for a lot of small papers, do you think that's going to have an important role in the future of what happens here?
I do. I don't necessarily think it will all be volunteer, though. I think that to be successful, hyperlocal will need to have some professional, in some sense of the word, editorial, you know, that relying on it to be 100% volunteer is only, first of all, I think it only works in certain kinds of communities.
What would be the kinds of communities it would work best in?
Well, communities where people have some sense of community and some level of income that allows for some, you know, people to have free time. And so, you know, it's education and income levels and cohesiveness or homogeneity. So, you know, that could be, I mean, in some cases that might be ethnic communities or, you know, communities that have something else in common other than geography. But for the geographic, for the hyperlocal, you know, you see it working in places like New Hampshire, where there's a fairly successful one called The Forum, although which is, interestingly enough, started as an online news publication and has discovered that it has to reverse publish. So they discovered that their advertisers and some of their readers just weren't happy with something that was only on the web. So they ended up, they started as a web publication and then became an occasional print publication. So they print out, they do a print version of the paper, like, I don't know, several times a year. It's sort of an odd thing, but they do it for certain, like they do it for the local county fair and certain other times of the year.
And they call it reverse publishing?
Yeah, that's not their term. That's a term that other people have used. Yeah. But yeah, reverse publishing is a thing where, and there are other organizations too that have found this out or have decided that in fact, you know, paper delivery is still important to reach certain kinds of people or to satisfy certain kinds of advertisers or whatever. And so they're starting up publications now that also have a paper component.
What's interesting to me, too, in particular in the South Jersey area where we publish The Voice, is even though it's a very difficult climate for print news publications, and we have a Gannett paper that has had – or several Gannett papers that have gone through layoffs, and we have the Philadelphia Inquirer, which is, you know, endlessly downsizing, that there is still there have still been several – high-end magazine startups in the market because advertisers want that print delivery.
Oh yeah.
So it's just in spite of the economic circumstances facing print publications, people still perceive a value and perceive a need for it. So where do you think it's all going to head? What are you know some of your predictions for at least 2009? You may not be able to go much further than that at this point.
Well, I do think that there will be some print publications that continue to do well. I mean, the ethnic press in many places is doing very well. You know, publications that have stronger ties to their audience and their advertisers than the average, you know, big city daily. I mean, the problem with the big city daily was the whole advertising thing was a bit of a myth. You know, no one really knew how many people were actually looking at those ads because you don't know what pages of the paper people look at. And the fact is that the content of those dailies is still very popular. People look at it on the web, but they can't figure out how to charge the same kind of money they charged when they could claim that the entire circulation of the newspaper must have been looking at those ads, even though everyone knew that's a farce, you know, the entire circulation of the paper doesn't look at every page of the paper. They don't look at those ads. But there was, you know, sort of no place else to be. If you wanted to be on paper and if you wanted to be in a certain locale, that was what you had to do. And now there are so many other options for advertisers. But if you look at New America Media, the stuff that ethnic media are doing, some of it in other languages, but some of it simply about communities that aren't being well served, and publications that really know their communities are still doing well.
And you know, the option of narrow casting, which we've heard about a lot in the context of the web, you can get to a very small audience. The trick is, how do you figure out how to get to those people when you have a large publication.
Right, right. I mean, the stuff that the publication, large publications are putting out is still finding plenty of audiences, but it's finding it one article at a time. And that's not what they're set up to make money on. So the large general interest publications are set up to make money by gathering as large an audience as possible for a as large a group of stuff as they can put together in one place, which is no longer a good model. But for people who can pull together very specific things serving a very specific audience, and also if you can guarantee a very specific audience that is useful to certain kinds of advertisers, that's a much better place to be in.
Very interesting. Any other thoughts on where things might shake out?
I don't know. I'm frightened to make predictions. The amount of stuff that's changed just in the time that I was writing my report has, blown everybody out of the water. I mean, everybody's been, there's been more stuff happening in terms of how fast the bigger newspapers are shaking out and changing things than I think any of us expected even in 2008. So it's really hard to say. I think the one thing that people should be preparing for that I think they're not, and I'm very curious to see when it's going to suddenly explode here, is mobile.
Mobile in the sense of people getting information on their handheld devices?
Yes. It's happening. I mean, the rest of the world is way ahead of the United States on this, and at some point it's going to come around and something's going to click. It's going to hit a tipping point, and then all of a sudden people who haven't been figuring out how to be on mobile are going to be.
I'm already reading several newspapers on my cell
exactly.
phone. So it's only a matter of time before that becomes, a primary source rather than a backup source.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Well, we'll check back with you as we go through 2009 and see if anything changes more dramatically. And we thank you for taking the time to be with us on the podcast.
Great. Thanks so much. It's been my pleasure.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the CompuSchmooze podcast. If you did, please tell your friends, or better yet, send them a link to the program so they can enjoy it themselves. If you have comments or suggestions about our programs, please email me. The address is steve@compuschmooze, CompuSchmooze.com. We'd also be pleased to receive audio comments. If you'd like, you can send us an MP3 file to that address. Or if you'd like, call our podcast comment line. In the U.S., it's 856-861-6146, and that'll work for Canada as well, all over North America. And you can call us in the U.K. at +44 020 7193 6146. We produce these programs in the studios of Professional Podcasts in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, on the web at professionalpodcasts.com. This is Steve Lubetkin. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you out there on the net. Take good care.